It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, we'll learn about how scientists are using sound in new and unexpected ways in their research. Our regular science expert, Gemma Tarlak, has that and other stories behind the latest science headlines. First, a survey released today says that nearly 9 out of 10 adults have health insurance, partly in thanks to the Affordable Care Act. The latest numbers from the Gallup Healthways Well-Being Index also show that more Hispanics have found insurance under the Affordable Care Act than any other ethnic or racial group. Here to take us behind those numbers is Tom Oliver, professor of population health sciences at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
Well, Tom, these numbers show a gradual increase in healthcare enrollment since the Affordable Care Act. What do you make of the latest numbers?
Well, if we were to think of the American health insurance system as a patient, we would be really delighted to see that not only has it recovered from hemorrhaging back in 2008 through 2010, but it is fully recovered and is actually healthier now than it has been in decades. To put it in perspective, we now have fewer uninsured Americans than we've had since the first President Bush left office and President Clinton came into the White House.
Well, the Affordable Care Act, as I understand it, had three goals, one of which, of course, was to lower the rate of people who are uninsured. But how is it doing overall at meeting its goals?
Well, it's well on its way to a number of goals, but of course that's been after a lot of pitfalls along the way, challenges in the courts and challenges in putting together the enrollment process in the insurance exchanges, among many of them, and it remains to be seen. Still this summer, the Supreme Court has to rule on whether some of the subsidies that help make the insurance affordable, that have allowed many millions of people to get health insurance who have not been able to previously, it remains to be seen whether this process will continue to get stronger and stronger. One of the pleasant outcomes of this whole process over the last few years has been, while we've continued to see millions and millions of Americans, tens of millions now, get insurance coverage who were previously uninsured, health care costs, which in theory should go up quite a bit when that happens, have actually stabilized, and the rate of increase in health care insurance has been lower than it has been in decades. So the kinds of things that we're seeing right now, you'd have to go all the way back to 1965 when Medicare and Medicaid provided new insurance to tens of millions of Americans to see sort of the change that's going underway. But so far, so good. Lots more people with access to care. And lots more people being able to maintain that affordability because healthcare cost increases have slowed dramatically.
Obviously, there could be a lot of factors involved here. How much do you think we can ascribe the increased enrollment to the program itself, and how much to something else, like, say, improvement in the economy?
The economy recovering, however slow and uneven it's been for different groups in the population, has been a major factor in employers dropping health insurance and being able to continue it. But it's clear that many employer-based insurance individuals have moved from getting care and not particularly good deals for insurance from their small groups and employers into the insurance exchanges set up under the Affordable Care Act. That's several million people. Many millions of people, probably about 12 million or so, have now been able to get coverage through Medicaid expansions in 28 states and the District of Columbia, who have agreed to accept the funds and set up higher income eligibility for Medicaid for individuals and families. And we currently have a lot of people who have been able to get coverage with their families who are under age 26 because they were allowed to remain within family coverage. So there's different segments of people, but it's, again, a few million to quite a few million in each of these pockets that were able to move from being uninsured or potentially losing insurance now back into pretty mainstream coverage. And I think a lot of folks are grateful to see that happening.
Now, Hispanics saw the biggest gains in coverage in this last report. Why the difference with that group, do you think?
That is just an amazing and wonderful thing to see because traditionally, as long as I've been watching this, and that's for several decades now, Hispanics have had three times the rate of uninsurance of the general population. And that's because of the nature of their employment. It's because some of them have just come to this country. They may be citizens, but very recent. Others may be here in an undocumented or illegal status. None of those things then allows you to, whether you don't make enough money or you don't have legal status, to get health care coverage. The insurance coverage that's now available to Hispanics is basically because the Medicaid program and the insurance pools have allowed individuals to come on their own with subsidies if they're here legally, and that's a tremendous thing. So the other thing that's important is that the Community Health Centers program was expanded substantially under the Affordable Care Act, and that's where a lot of individuals who cannot see a regular doctor or get to a clinic on an ordinary basis or have someone who speaks Spanish or other languages, they come in that front door, and the community health center is then able to determine if they're actually eligible, not just for free care or discounted care, but actually eligible for insurance coverage legally. And so that has been a great front door where the community health centers have helped find the way to decide where you can get coverage and help people get signed up. So that probably is a little bit of the piece of the picture as well.
We're talking right now with Tom Oliver, professor of population health sciences at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, about some new enrollment numbers for the Affordable Care Act. And Tom, there is a new report out by the New Commonwealth Fund, which outlines some disparities in people's ability to afford health care in certain states. In particular, it looks like states that declined the Medicaid expansion money. What's the story there?
Well, it's a pretty obvious one that if you didn't take the money, and if you're in a state that has a lot of uninsured people and you didn't take the money to expand the Medicaid coverage, which means raising eligibility from the federal poverty level, which is only about $12,000 per person, up to 133% of the federal poverty level, you basically have left, again, millions of people out of the system because they cannot afford or even have eligibility to receive the subsidies to buy individual insurance through the exchanges. So the big states with lots of uninsured people, California, Florida, Texas, primarily among them, have tens of millions of people who could get into the system with this expansion. But while California accepted the Medicaid expansion, Florida and Texas did not. So as a result, you've got very, very high percentages of uninsured individuals still, especially in Texas, also in Florida. And while there's still lots of folks uninsured in California, they've made rapid progress compared to where they were. So apparently, that Medicaid expansion is a very big deal in terms of cutting the ranks of the uninsured. And New York was the other state in that study that has made tremendous progress and is now doing much better than the national average.
Do we know how turning down that expansion money has played out in Wisconsin?
Well, it simply has a fair number of hundreds of thousands of folks who could potentially get coverage either through Medicaid or other means through the Badger Care program. It simply keeps them in the tens of thousands, about 70 to 80,000, the estimates that I've seen, from having an opportunity to get well-subsidized health care. And so, you know, when you are really having trouble having full hours of work, receiving decent wages, paying your rent, trying to afford transportation to get to your job and things like that, it's a big struggle, and certainly it's almost impossible to afford health insurance on your own without either access to the subsidies or to the Medicaid coverage, which comes almost cost-free to individuals who are eligible. So it's a big deal to a very substantial number of people in Wisconsin, and we'll just have to see how things play out over the next few years, because a number of states that did not initially accept the Medicaid expansion have now chosen to do so.
Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Take care.
We've been speaking with Tom Oliver, professor of population health sciences at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. We've been talking about the latest Gallup figure showing that nearly 9 out of 10 Americans now have health insurance. We're talking about new ways scientists are using to inform their research, how humans are evolving maybe the wrong way, and other headlines with our science expert Gemma Tarlak. Gemma's senior associate editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to give us the stories behind headlines in the science world. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello. How are you doing?
Doing well, thanks. How about you?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Well, we're going to start off by talking about the way the science of sound is revolutionizing research in the science world. What's going on with sound?
Yeah, this is a really interesting story because, you know, we don't think of all the different ways, of all the different sounds out there and how they might actually be applicable to research. And there's a whole range of projects. I'll just mention a couple of my favorites. They are looking at the ultra-low frequency sound waves that are emitted by gases within stars. And they're finding that they can use these sound waves to measure how old the stars are relative to each other and all these different traits, because the sound waves actually show up as rhythmic changes in brightness and temperature. And this is just, you know, you would never think, how can I, you know, hear the sound of the stars and learn about them? But it's an actual practice that they're doing and getting a lot of great data with. So that's kind of a, you know, way out there, literally, application. but then one much closer to home, you know, if you're a birder or a fan of seabirds, you know that they tend not to build colonies in the most accessible places, you know, like a sea rock out in the middle of nowhere, such. Well, it's really hard to monitor how big the colonies are and how healthy they are if you got to take the rowboat, you know, miles out to sea or whatever. But now they're finding they can just put a microphone in the seabird colony and just by the sound alone monitor the size and health of the colony, which is not only a great way to get data, but, you know, I mean, your tax dollars at work, they're being thrifty, folks.
First of all, it's amazing that gases from stars have a sound. I would never have thought that was something that scientists could study. But once you get past that, I mean, is this essentially, can this yield research with measurable results, or is it always going to be sort of a spitball kind of thing if you're using sound?
Oh, no. I mean, these are definitely legitimate results, and it's legitimate data. And it's just, you know, if you think about looking at an image through a telescope and you see it fluctuate, say, in brightness, well, you're looking at it and you're using the sight of something to get data. This is basically the same thing. It's just instead of sight, you're using sound. So it's absolutely legitimate research, and some have even had findings. For example, the caterpillars. Can I talk about the caterpillar study? I love it. So researchers at the University of Missouri played a recording of munching caterpillars, just caterpillars going yum, 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 yum. And they played it next to these plants, and they found that when the plants heard the sound of the caterpillars, they released larger amounts of naturally occurring anti-insect chemicals than the control group that didn't get to hear the munching caterpillars. And so that, you know, that's an actual result, and they can use it in agricultural research and just learning more about how plants function. So plants can apparently, you know,
hear
caterpillars at least.
Yeah, there's so much. We could spend the whole amount of our time on these munching caterpillars and plants thing. But we should move on to our next story now. A big story about disevolution. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that properly, but how humans are passing dysfunctional genes on to the next generation. What's going on with that?
Yeah, this is actually our cover story, and it's the true story of our writer, Jeff Wheelwright, who went bravely to see this evolutionary biologist who is looking at disevolution. That's DYS evolution. And it's the idea that, you know, for millions of years, our ancestors developed very slowly. Natural selection took place. If there was a mutation that put out a great trait that gave us an advantage, cool. We evolved to have that trait, but if it didn't work out, it kind of fell by the wayside, and it never really became, part of our species. So natural selection takes a long time, and that was pretty much what our species has been doing until about 10,000 years ago, when agriculture kicked in. We went from being hunter-gatherers to a much more sedentary population that used farming for our main means of food production. That caused some problems, and he calls that a cultural evolutionary switch. But even more problems arose after the Industrial Revolution. When you think of how much our lives have changed, not just in the past 10,000 years, but just in the past couple centuries, natural selection and sort of natural biological evolution has not kept up at all with cultural evolution. That's why we have eyeglasses and flat feet and all these other problems, obesity, etc., that are just really taking a toll on our species. We haven't had time to adapt to it all.
So what does that mean long run? Does that mean that these traits stick around forever and don't get weeded out, or that it just takes a lot longer?
Well, that is, the $64,000 question or so. And the researcher is actually advocating for us to do as much as we can to prevent these problems. For example, back in the day, hunter-gatherers had a sweet tooth because it was a very nutrient-rich source of food for them. Nowadays, with a fast food shop on every corner, et cetera, we should be staying away from sweets because, for us, they cause obesity and cavities and all these other problems that our ancestors didn't have. So he's saying, let's look at where disevolution mismatches have cropped up, and let's try to do something preventively about them. For example, back in the day, we got a lot of exercise running around, chasing game, looking for food, etc. Nowadays, we're very, very sedentary, so we really need to amp up the amount of physical activity we do. And it's little changes like that, but, when you read the whole story and how he kind of analyzed our writer and all the things that he was doing wrong, it's just kind of a wake-up call. Like, if you haven't laced up your running shoes yet, this story is going to make you want to do it.
Well, we're talking about some new science headlines right now out of Discover Magazine with Gemma Tarlak. And before we leave this story, Gemma, he has something to say about the paleo diet. Now, this presumably would be something our ancestors did and therefore maybe a good selective thing to do. What's the take on that?
Well, yeah, one of the interesting things he says about the paleo diet, for example, if you sit down to a nice big plate of 21st century vegetables, as, our hunter-gatherer forebears did, you're not going to get the same nutrients. You're not going to get the same amount of fiber, et cetera, as they did when they sat down to, a nice big pile of vegetables. And that's because as we've domesticated vegetables over time, we selected out for some of the nutritious things in favor of some of the tastier things. For example, a lot of vegetables have much less fiber than they did centuries ago because, fiber, it's hard to chew, takes a long time, whatever. But, ooh, look at this nice, soft, mushy potato or turnip. Mmm, delicious. So even if you try to recreate the paleo diet, you're not going to do it. And he comes out pretty strongly against the paleo diet as this kind of returning back to nature. He's got several good reasons for that.
Okay, well, we're going to wrap up with a story about Google Earth changing the way archaeology is practiced. Obviously, Google Earth has a lot of applications. What is it doing to this field?
Well, it's been 10 years since Google Earth has been out there available to anyone, and professional archaeologists do not use it that much. They might use it for some logistical planning, but they have much more advanced forms of imagery that can really help them pinpoint what they're looking for. At the same time, the availability of Google Earth has turned up this whole big field of amateur archaeologists who are going out there and making some pretty amazing finds. One of the people I interviewed for the story, Peter Welsh from England, he and his group just found one of the largest coin hoards ever found in, the English countryside. And fortunately, he's on the up and up, and he made sure that as soon as they found that discovery, they called in an archaeologist who helped excavate it properly so the context could be recorded, which is crucial in archaeology. And then all the coins are actually now at the British Museum being cleaned and hopefully put on display. So he did all that. He started with Google Earth. But there are a lot of armchair archaeologists out there who maybe aren't isn't so up on the up and up. And, you know, it's tempting if you're hiking along and you see an arrowhead or a shard of pottery or whatever. You pick it up, think, oh, this is cool. Well, as soon as you pick it up, you pretty much ruin it, because in archaeology, the context is everything. It's where was it found, what was it found next to, and what layer of the soil. So even though there are some armchair archaeologists who are doing it right, and we introduce you to a few of them in the story, professional archaeologists are kind of wringing their hands about people who just kind of blunder in using Google Earth. So while it's attracting a lot of interest into the archaeology field, it's also stirring up a lot of controversy.
And we leave it there, Gemma. Fun as always. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. You take care.
We've been speaking with Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She's with us every month to talk about the latest from the world of science. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. This week is Young Professionals Week in Wisconsin. The state loses about 9,000 potential young professionals each year, or people between the ages of 21 and 40, according to the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. This week is dedicated to getting those people to stay and to attract even more young professionals from beyond state lines. Wisconsin turns out thousands of students from the UW system every year, but lots of them are attracted to bigger cities like Chicago or Minneapolis. The goal of this week is to showcase what Wisconsin's smaller cities, places like Fond du Lac, Wausau, Sheboygan, have to offer millennials in addition to Madison and Milwaukee. The campaign is organized by the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation in collaboration with young professional organizations around the state. Here with us now is Angela Damiani, president of New Waukee, a Milwaukee-based social architecture firm. Angela, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And here in the studio with us, we have Chief Operating Officer of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. We've got Tricia Brown. Tricia, welcome.
Hi, and well, thank you.
And Tricia, we'll start with you. What are the consequences of young professionals leaving Wisconsin, part of what's commonly known as the brain drain?
Well, you know, just to start off, it's really not just a Wisconsin issue. I think as companies and corporations look to see where their growth is going to occur in the future, one of the key decision factors is looking at that talent pipeline. And so, you know, when we're talking about losing 9,000 professionals a year, that's 9,000 people in our future workforce that are leaving. And so it's, I would say, the top priority for companies across the state to be looking at investing ways to attract and retain and, really kind of grow that talent pool in their areas. And so from the state's perspective, you know, that's an area, it's not your typical incentive, it's not necessarily traditional economic development, but it's really important to make sure that we're addressing this issue now, and we're addressing it across all areas.
Are there particular industries in the state suffering more than others from the brain drain or the loss of these young professionals?
No, I can't think of any really industry-specific areas. It's really affecting everybody, from manufacturing to, the tech companies to your corporate headquarters. And, I think that's why, and Angela can even speak to this as well, is that the support for these efforts is really broad-based. And, at the awards ceremony, the types of companies that are addressing this, they range from the manufacturing companies to the retailers to banks and financial services. It's something that affects everybody.
And Angela, let's go to you now. What are you hearing about the need to keep young professionals here in Wisconsin and the lures that might draw them elsewhere?
Well, we hear it in all the conversations we have, both with nonprofits saying we need young people to participate, to volunteer, to become potential donors. We can't seem to reach them. And also from corporations who are saying we can't seem to find the talent we need to actually run our business. And so Milwaukee founded YP Week as sort of a first step. We thought, all right, so perhaps the issue is that there's a lack of awareness. Maybe we can start by simply showing young professionals what the city has to offer. And now the exciting part is that we're looking at what the state has to offer and really branding Wisconsin as a workplace destination underneath this unified umbrella.
And Angela, what do you think that bigger cities have that, Wisconsin doesn't? There's the perception, at least, that if a person goes to a bigger market, they might have better job growth. Is that unfounded?
I don't know. You know, it's an interesting thing because I agree, if you live in New York, you're in the mecca for culture, but you're also paying a lot more for your rents, and it's harder to get places. I think one of the unique selling propositions for Wisconsin is that it's easy to live here. And if you don't want to have your life's work be struggling to survive, if you want to actually be able to spend your paycheck on the amazing cultural amenities there are or participating in a variety of different offerings each community like has, I think Wisconsin is a great option.
And Tricia, I know one thing that is being considered right now is the forecast of baby boomers retiring and leaving lots of empty jobs behind them. How serious is that when you look at retaining young professionals?
It's incredibly serious. You know, when we talk about the out-migration of people, and then you couple that with just the sheer reduction in numbers across the globe, basically, you know, that's scary. That means that by starting to address this now and looking at ways that at least the people that are here we keep here, as well as become a draw for future professionals when they're determining where they want to live and, you know, start their families, that Wisconsin is their destination of choice. You know, that puts us in a competitive position. And, you know, Angela mentioned brand. I think that's really where it takes an event like YP Week to generate excitement across the state, not just for, you know, young professionals, but for the companies, and looking at, okay, here is a way that we can get involved and we can learn from each other. And as a state, we can be stronger. You know, one event in one area as a standalone will have, you know, an impact on the area. But when you couple it with everything else that's going on, that's where that buzz comes in. And then, you know, other states, other regions, they start to take note, like, hey, Wisconsin's doing some pretty cool things. And that's what I think kind of calls the attention to us that we want, that makes it, okay, there is something cool going on there. Maybe we need to check it out and just kind of change the conversation a little bit.
So speaking of cool things going on, Angela, tell us some of what is going to be happening this week at Young Professionals Week.
Absolutely. Well, the tagline is that it's a week-long adventure and discovery around conversations that matter for young professionals. And so that conversation is going to take a variety of different forms. Some things are really traditional. Like in Madison, we're going to have a keynote address by Rebecca Ryan, who's nationally regarded as a millennial expert and a futurist. But it's also some non-traditional activities, too. For instance, this morning, there was a local fitness center that hosted a boot camp in Lambeau Field at 6 in the morning in Green Bay. And so it's a variety of different offerings, hopefully enticing the young professionals in each community to explore parts of the city that they haven't necessarily had a chance to, or maybe they haven't previously had access to, and an amazing opportunity for there to be some exchange between leadership, because in each community we have both public and private leaders in the rooms with young professionals that, quite frankly, because they tend to be still in the beginnings of their careers, they don't have access to the CEOs or the mayors. And so there's a nice generational exchange that the week allows for as well.
We're talking right now with Angela Damiani, president of Newaukee, and Tricia Brown, deputy secretary and chief operating officer of Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. And we're talking about Young Professionals Week going on right now, an effort to keep young professionals in the state. And Angela, when we talk about young professionals, this is 21 to 40. Are we talking mostly about millennials here?
We really are. And, you know, we're talking a lot about this brain drain issue, but I think the part that we're ignoring is that we're also talking about a generational shift when it comes to the communication and the technologies that are in play. And so I think every generation, when there's that passing of the torch, struggles a little bit, right? Because there's a bit of an ego with people who are the old guard passing on to the new guard. But for whatever reason, this transition seems a little bit rockier than at least what I've seen from, you know, prior generations. And I think a lot of that has to do with the technology and the fact that there is so much information all the time. And the nice part about YP Week is we're able to introduce things to young professionals and to that millennial audience that they perhaps wouldn't otherwise be paying attention to, because there are systems in place for some of these old school conversations. So I'll give you a really good example. Here in Milwaukee, we have an incredible ballet. It's a cultural institution that we were very grateful for as a community. But as you can imagine, their traditional season ticket holders are an older subset of our population here, and they have been willing to try to play with that audience, to try to do something new. And so Wednesday night, we will have the ballet actually play in the midst of a cocktail party to two local hip-hop artists. So there's going to be a really experiential introduction for people who perhaps are curious about the ballet, but they don't know what to wear. Is it worth buying the ticket? You know, all of the questions that you may have in terms of that barrier to entry will be really solved, because it'll be an incredible experience, and it causes new exposure for that arts nonprofit that is seeking that audience.
And I've read that some cities are trying to retool themselves to be more attractive to this demographic of young professionals. Wausau is trying to foster more farm-to-table restaurants, to build more, I think, condos and housing in the downtown. Is that typical, Tricia, of what we're seeing about cities as they try to refocus and retain?
Yeah, actually, it leads me to a good point. That's one of the other advantages of a community really trying to engage and reach out to this demographic, is that as these young professionals engage in a community and they become, whether it's a nonprofit organization or even something simple as a community cleanup or a fun event, something social, they become part of it. They feel more connected to it, and they feel like, okay, they can help to shape and to improve the area, which is really important for that millennial population. The other piece of it is that, you know, millennials think differently. They challenge, you know, the traditional mindset. And so by, you know, if a community planning group or a city council reaches out to their millennials and they ask for their input and for their thoughts on something, they get ideas that, you know, maybe haven't been thought of before, but add a lot of cool aspects to a community.
This week is Young Professionals Week in Wisconsin, an effort to retain and attract young professionals to the state. And we're talking now with Angela Damiani, president of Newwalkie, a Milwaukee-based social architecture firm, and Tricia Brown, deputy secretary and chief operating officer of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. And we'd like to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. Are you a young professional in Wisconsin? Why did you choose to stay? Were you on the fence for a while? And if so, what swayed you in one direction or the other? Do you see particular benefits to having a career in a small or a mid-sized city instead of one of the big centers on the coast or in Chicago? And what do you think Wisconsin could do better to attract young professionals? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. This week is Young Professionals Week in Wisconsin, and we're continuing our conversation about efforts to retain and attract millennials to the state. Wisconsin loses about 9,000 people between the ages of 21 and 40 every year. And we'd love to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. Is your town or your city struggling to retain and attract millennials? What are you doing about it? And have you left Wisconsin at one point or another for a bigger job market? Or did you choose to stay in a smaller city in Wisconsin? Let us know how you made your decision at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Staying with us now, we have Angela Damiani, president of Newwalkie, and Tricia Brown from the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. And we go to the phones now. We've got Justin joining us in Green Bay. Hi, Justin.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good, thanks. What do you think?
I'm a young profession. I just graduated becoming a chef. And I live here in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and I noticed that with the career, my career choice, that there isn't much open doors here in Green Bay. So I have to expand to bigger cities just to get my foot in the door to bigger restaurants and then expand my dream of being the best chef there is, you know?
Got it. Thank you for sharing your story with us, Justin. And I guess, you know, at the end of the day, Tricia, is it all about jobs? If there are jobs here, then you'll have young professionals. If there aren't jobs, they're going to go somewhere else.
Well, in some industries where it is very specific, something like a chef or a fashion designer, you maybe do have to start off in an area where there is a higher concentration of companies. And, you know, I think that's the key. Start off there. And, you know, look at ways that you could find opportunities in the future, whether it's starting your own restaurant in this particular case, or partnering, you know, with a chain that wants to expand back in Wisconsin. So, you know, it does have to have the right fit for people yet. But I think, you know, that the opportunities hopefully are there in other cities in Wisconsin, you know, not necessarily just Chicago, but yeah, I mean, I that's definitely a factor.
Thanks a lot for that call, Justin. And we're going to go next to Margaret in Eau Claire. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I have a daughter who graduated last May, and she's an RN, and her husband graduated in December, and he's an electrical engineer. We live by Eau Claire. The two of them chose to move to the Twin Cities because, well, the first reason is because they want to have children, and the schools in the state are being decimated. There's a lack of respect for public workers. And finally, they can make a third more money over there, and it costs almost the same to live in Minneapolis as it does in Eau Claire.
All right, Margaret, thanks a lot for your call. And a story there from Margaret. Angela, what do you make of that story? And, you know, she's saying you can make, at least in her daughter and son-in-law's case, 33% more in a bigger market, in this case, Minneapolis.
I think Minneapolis is an interesting exception because it is a big city, but it is still very Midwestern. And I think to Trisha's point, it's totally fine with most people. If people plan to go and get their skills sharpened and be able to come back and continue to be really talented, I'll take all the boomerangs we can get. It only helps to serve us to have the most talented people here. And if there are extra experiences that people want to have, I mean, I'm not originally from Milwaukee. I moved here 6 years ago. I grew up in the West Coast, and I was actually living abroad when I decided to come down into Milwaukee. And I think you just need to know what else is out there in order to realize how good you're going to have it here in the state.
And you said you'll take the boomerangs, the people who come back, but how do you know they're going to come back once they leave? How do you make sure that they do come back, Angela?
I don't know if there's a foolproof thing. If we could figure that out and patent it, I think we would be very, very rich, right? Because this is a global fight for talent. This is not just a Milwaukee problem or a Wisconsin problem. Even in San Francisco, the largest of the corporations, the Googles and the Apples, complain about not being able to find enough talent, about the talent wanting to leave to go start their own startups. This is a problem that our entire economy rests on. And so, you know, with the week, we're trying to start square one. Let's talk about what already exists and how amazing it is and give you access to it if you haven't already been exposed to it. Here's an opportunity for you to get a taste test. We hope that that entices you to delve and go deeper, to join that nonprofit, to patronize the arts, and then long-term make you want to stay.
And we're talking about Young Professionals Week right now. We're going to go next to Mike joining us in Colgate. Mike, hi.
Hi. I'd like to comment on Young Professionals. My daughter was home from UW-Madison over the Easter break, and we went for a walk, and she informed me that she thought maybe after she was done, she's an MD program out there, that she probably would move out of the state. And I wasn't surprised, but I questioned her. She said, well, she just didn't think that the state was as progressive or really, I guess it was more attitude, that the state, she might have been reeling from a $5,000 tuition increase that's coming, I guess. But, you know, in addition to her education all the way through high school, grade school, I know our district, it seems like education is not, for her kids also, a priority. That there, it's more priority for, and no disrespect, for our older generation, and that the younger generation kind of has to fight for what it gets.
Mike,
more of an attitude.
Mike, thank you for that call. And Trisha, what do you say to that? Some perceptions there about what's going on, you know, with the state budget, it sounds like, but also some attitudes about education. What do you think about Mike's comment?
You know, I think it does go back to the perception issue. And I have to say, I left the Midwest and was in Southern California for about 10 years and then decided to come back here because I missed the same reasons that, you know, might be given when somebody leaves, because your priorities change and your outlook changes. You know, I think you still cannot compete with the Midwest ethic, and whether that's in your own children or the workforce or whatever it might be. And, you know, students that come out of Midwest schools, they're sought after in other states, so they may be recruited away. But it is when you get to the point where you have to make those decisions long term, you know, coming back actually provides a lot of opportunities. You know, and Wisconsin does have to shift, and the way that they talk about themselves, the way that they brand themselves. You know, we're not just beer and cheese; we're a lot more, and that message has to get out. You know, to the other states, other regions.
And Tricia, just briefly from a policy standpoint, what is the state doing to attract and retain these professionals, these young professionals that we're talking about today?
Well, it really is this. You know, when we looked at Milwaukee and the model that they've created in the Milwaukee area, and especially with YP Week, that's something we said, you know, we can take that. Milwaukee, will you help us, you know, replicate your model in other areas throughout the state, build a best practice, and give them some guidance on what they can do to be a part of, I feel like an effort that's made a great impact in the Milwaukee area. Can you help us have that same benefit across the state?
And well, and I'll just add as well, I apologize to interrupt, but it's already starting to shift. We have every single state across the nation watching YP Week. We can see that from the back end of our website, and we have visitors coming and calls coming in saying, how do we do this in Orlando, Florida? How do we do this in Lincoln, Nebraska? So this coalition is exciting, and the programs this week are going to be really well attended, but it is already starting to shape shift that national perspective of what it means to be a young professional in Wisconsin and why you should choose Wisconsin.
And we leave it there. Angela, thank you so much for joining us.
Perfect. Thank you.
And Tricia, thanks to you as well.
Thank you so much.
This week is Young Professionals Week in Wisconsin. We've been talking about that with Angela Damiani, president of Newwalkie, a Milwaukee-based social architecture firm, and Tricia Brown with the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. A crucial piece of tech and media history went down today on April 13th of 2000. That's the day the heavy metal band Metallica sued the music sharing application called Napster. So basically what happened is Metallica's song I Disappear from the Mission Impossible 2 soundtrack popped up on Napster, then it got played on the radio, all this before it had been officially released by the band, which was the sticking point. And, of course, this was back when the term MP3 was still really new. And beforehand, we pretty much called this kind of thing a mixtape. Well, that lawsuit paved the way for the iTunes and iPods and the whole ongoing battle between artists and the tech industry that we still see playing out today. Well, it started in the year 2000 when Metallica sued over this song.